From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when researchers based in Canada detected something mysterious coming from 500 million light years away. A signal coming from space. It was a radio signal, but not just one radio wave. Starting in the fall of 2018, all the way through the fall of 2019, the researchers detected 28 individual radio wave bursts or patterns, including one that repeats with a very regular pattern. It appears every 16 days. The source sends one or two bursts of radio waves every hour over 4 days. Then it goes quiet for 12 days. And then the process would repeat. Even the skeptics at Vox Media were forced to ask, hey, what the hell is this? Vox writes, quote, there are a couple of things we know for sure. The 16-day period cannot be occurring by chance coincidence, the scientists write, and it's an important clue to the nature of the object. It's clear that the radio bursts can't be originating from a cataclysmic event like a star-going supernova, since that's a one-time affair. But beyond that, the scientists really aren't sure, end quote. And you know where I'm going with this. It's aliens! Finally! Well, in true wet blanket fashion, the researchers don't list aliens as one of the possibilities, but the chair of the Harvard Astronomy Department, Avi Loeb, speculates that the source of radio waves from space could be alien civilizations. There's a lot to digest from space lately. Here to help are my guests for the hour, the absolute resident skeptics who always talk me down. Brian Koberline's an astrophysicist and a science writer with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
And Roger Duby is an experimental physicist and a professor emeritus at RIT. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you so much.
All right, Brian, it's aliens, right?
Oh, yeah. It's always aliens.
Come on,
you.
Man. Can you? I mean, like, all right, I'm going to ask you a different way. I'm going to ask you, what percentage chance do you realistically think this is aliens?
I'll say, I can't prove it's not aliens.
Yes,
how about that?
Yes, that's a good place to start. You cannot prove it's not. But what's the chance that it is?
I really don't think we have enough information to really make an odds. I mean,
so
we
you're
never
telling
take,
me there
there's
a chance.
Yeah.
Very small chance.
There's always a very small chance. But, you know, we still have to figure out what the whole properties of this thing is. It's such a new thing that we're still gathering information about.
Okay. And one of the things we are going to talk more seriously about this hour is just the discussion alone about what we think about the search for life or signals of life. Because we've never discovered life, should we be skeptical that what we see, we can't pull an Evan Dawson and jump to aliens? Because it's never been aliens until it's, so maybe.
It's never aliens until it is.
I like that. Roger Duby, it's aliens, right?
I haven't been convinced, I have to say.
Okay. Any chance on this one?
Vanishingly small.
You'd be very surprised.
I would be very surprised. If it were, it seems to me that if it were aliens, they would do something more to get our attention than doing something regular and then off and then regular again. It just seems like such a primitive pattern that they would throw something else in there, surely. I mean, I know we would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going from your limited human capacity, you know?
Yes,
the Roger Duby,
yes,
Tesla
right.
driving.
This is what I would do,
you know,
to get their attention.
Improv comic Roger Duby.
Yes.
That's what you would do.
That's what I would do.
But my alien friends have a very different approach. They send very confusing signals from 500 million light years away, designed to throw us off the scent. Okay, so let's get a little bit more serious here. First of all, 500 million light years away does mean, just in case this were a civilization, it's probably not there anymore, right? I mean, what we're detecting is, in our time frame, it's a long time ago, right?
Well, so the Earth, no? There's a period during the Earth's history, about 400 million years ago, called the heavy bombardment period. And this is not long after Earth was formed, when the Earth was being hit by asteroids pretty much daily. That period of time is 100 million years after this. So these left the source 100 million years before the Earth was even, like, starting to come to life. We weren't even close. It's a long time ago. It's very far away. It's outside our galaxy.
And so I guess what I'm saying, Brian, is in the event that this is a civilization sending something, we're receiving the signal. I mean, unless this is a remarkably advanced and sustainable civilization, long after it decayed and became antimatter, regular matter, I don't know, whatever it's going to be there.
Well, how long do species typically last? I mean, the dinosaurs lasted for a very long time, and it wasn't even remotely close.
But they didn't have gas stations on every corner, you know?
That's true. But how long have humans been around? A few million years?
Well, it depends on if Australopithecus afarensis is...
Right, it depends on how far back you want to trace to call them homos. But, you know, that is still just a few million years, 5 million years. You know, it's not 500 million years.
Right.
So if it is an alien civilization, the odds that we know within, you know, life on Earth is that it is a dead civilization.
A dead civilization. Okay.
There's actually research that kind of supports that idea that if we detect an alien civilization, given the distances, it will more likely be a dead civilization than a currently living one.
Let me read what Loeb from Harvard said. Quote, fast radio bursts are one of astronomy's tantalizing unsolved mysteries. These sudden pulses of radio waves come from far outside our galaxy. They last about a millisecond, and sometimes the signals repeat. Until recently, that's about all the scientific community could say about fast radio bursts, or FRBs. Our radio telescopes, which pick up radio waves rather than visible light, first detected them in 2007. Since then, we've recorded a few dozen more, but not enough to be able to put together a compelling theory of what causes them. With the origin of these signals still unknown, it is possible aliens could be sending them. That's a Harvard guy, not some idiot hosting public radio in Rochester. That's a big leap. That last line's a big leap.
The last line's a big leap.
Okay. I mean, he doesn't give us a number, right? He says it's possible. That's, in our opinion, a vanishingly small possibility. It's not zero, but it is as close to zero as you can get right now. I think that the use of the word tantalizing is a really good marketing thing to do, because that's going to attract people to the program. So
one of our listeners is already asking which radio telescope specifically picked up the signals. Arizona, Chile, Hawaii, where? Someone has been to Chile. It wasn't Chile this time, was it? Or was it?
No. Green Bank has...
Green Bank, Canada.
West Virginia.
Green Bank, West Virginia.
West Virginia.
The latest ones were out of Canada. So these have been kind of observed before. And if you kind of want to know, like, what are these fast radio bursts, a good analogy is when your battery and your smoke detector goes down and you just hear that.
Yes.
And it's like, what was that?
And which room in the
house? And which room in the house?
And then you spend the next 2 hours looking for it.
And that's exactly one of the challenges has been, because we would detect these, but where are they coming from?
Can I just say, if human beings need to spend roughly 60 to 90 minutes to find a smoke detector sending a signal in their own house, the odds that we're going to find one of these in deep space seems vanishingly small. But how do we know where it's coming from? Brian, Roger, take me through this process of knowing what these things actually are, or everything we know about these kind of radio waves.
So when the first ones were being detected, they were being detected by a directed radio telescope, so in Australia or in Green Bank. And one of the hard parts of it is that if you're kind of observing in a certain direction, there's a certain width to the sky that signals coming from that direction can be detected by the telescope. So if you're kind of looking in that direction and then you see this radio burst, you know it's kind of in that direction, but you can't pin it down. So when they were first detected, you knew something of where the direction was, but not necessarily the specific source. What's changed is this telescope in Canada called CHIME is very different from other radio telescopes. Most radio telescopes focus on making a high-resolution image of a very small patch of sky. And what CHIME is doing is it's trying to map intergalactic hydrogen in intergalactic space. And so it is specifically designed, instead of like a radio dish, it's this long parabola. So it actually looks at a wide section of the sky all the time. And so when they happen, it can pinpoint where it is. It can't make a high-resolution image of it, but it can say whatever that was, it was from this spot, because that's what it's doing. It's designed to pinpoint where signals are coming from.
How do we know 500 million light-years away versus 250 million light-years away?
So there is a process by which when you have some type of signal in space, when the radio signals are going through interstellar space, they're going through ionized gas. And this causes a property called dispersion. You've heard them before, if you know, like on a radio thing, these things called whistlers, that type of thing. That's what's happening. Different frequencies come at different times, and so the frequency spreads out. It spreads out. These signals are spreading out so much that they can't happen in our galaxy. So basically, you can say by how much spread they are, this is how far they are away.
And they're radio waves, but I think the lay listeners, me included, think, oh, so they're sent from some sort of technological device. Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Lots of natural processes create radio light. It's light. It's just a long, long wavelength of light that we call radio.
Whenever you accelerate an electron, for example, through some electric field, it emits radiation at a variety of different wavelengths. And so you're going to see some long wavelength radio emissions. You're going to see others, depending on the speed that that electron is traveling at, you'll see different sort of different distributions of wavelengths of things that it's emitting. And there may indeed be some sort of process that's going on where a molecule changes its state, emits an electron, and then you get a burst of radio. So there are a variety of different mechanisms that can create these things, and they can occur at any of a number of different wavelengths.
But they can travel that far for that long?
It's light. If nothing gets in the way, it's coming. I mean, radio wave is light. It's just a different wavelength.
So we are sending radio waves as well?
Oh, we've been sending them.
We emit radio waves all the time.
I mean, I know we are, but I guess what I mean is we're sending radio waves hundreds of millions of miles into space as well? Yes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They get fainter the farther you go because it spreads out.
Like a flashlight from far away.
Exactly.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But we're doing that. Okay.
But we still do that.
Okay. In a moment, I'll talk about what the researchers think could be causing this. But the reason I think this one got so much heat is because of the pattern of the signals. It wasn't, hey, we detected more radio waves. It was every 16 days, it starts a four-day pattern of bursts on the hour, and then it stops for 12 days, and then it picks up the pattern again. Come on. Tell me what is doing the pattern like that.
There's a reason why in the movie Contact, when aliens...
Let's do this. Contact is a great reference point.
It's a great reference. The signal that came was both loud and non-periodic. So when the signal that was first detected was this loud burst that came in prime numbers. So it did 2 and then 3 and then 5 and so forth. And the reason it was that way is because periodic patterns are almost certainly natural. Because things...
What?
Periodic patterns are almost certainly natural.
We said that in the beginning of the program. I was saying it would be much more complex if it were an alien race. That's just a fact. You're going to get things that are very periodic if it comes from a natural process. You're going to get a rotating neutron star, things going around other things.
All right, but let's say you toss a garbage can down the stairs. Mm-hmm. It's going to make a bunch of banging sounds, and then it's going to stop. Versus you're working for the Houston Astros, and every 3 minutes you're banging on the can to send a signal to a batter. That's periodic. That's created. It's the randomness of the noise of something falling down the stairs that isn't periodic. I would think the civilized life form is periodic, I guess.
The sun rises about the same time every day. The seasons happen on a predictable cycle. Lots of things in nature are extraordinarily repetitive. Pulsars are a good example of this. These radio patterns that were just regular and all the time. They joked about them being little green men. They didn't think that they were aliens, but they were some process, some natural process that just creates this regular pattern. We now know they're neutron stars.
All right. So the point being, if we get radio waves and they are in a regular pattern, that isn't an indication that it's probably created by civilized life.
Right.
Right.
The opposite.
Yep.
Right.
It fails the Roger Dubey complexity test.
Right.
That's
the ideal
such a
thing,
bummer.
Ideally would be something that's not periodic and also something that happens at a frequency that doesn't happen in space, for example. So if you had a radio frequency that's very hard to get the right conditions in space and then it's non-periodic, that would flag something that seems artificial.
Well, you referenced Contact, and I'm actually excited about that only because I really do like when fiction does a decent job of handling the science. And we've talked about this with our guests a number of times as Hollywood has taken stabs at interstellar space, movies like Interstellar. Was Contact at least interesting in that way, the way they presented what the waves would have been like?
I think it did a really good example of one way that aliens could stand out from all the natural stuff.
So, you know, as you know, the concept was they were receiving our television broadcasts from the 30s and 40s, and they were retransmitting them back to us to get our attention. And so that's the complexity that you're likely to get from an advanced species.
Steve, by the way, writes to the program and says, please stop trying to impose your personal belief on scientists. Stop trying to reason with scientists with your own flawed logic is actually what he said. It's, you know, it's tongue-in-cheek logic. This is a great learning experience. Though it is interesting that a lot of the headlines keyed in on these periodic things as if that was a sign, which probably just goes to show you the scientific education of the lay public still has a long way to go.
Well, right. and the movie Contact did start off with a periodic signal that they recognized. And it's when they started to break it, to open it up and look at the closer construction of that pulse that they realized, oh, this is a TV frame. And then they were able to reconstruct these TV broadcasts.
Okay. Go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say the periodic aspect is actually where scientists are interested, because these bursts are, since they're so far away and the strength of the signal that we're getting, they have to be extraordinarily powerful. Something powerful has to be causing them. And whenever you have really powerful, really fast bursts of energy, the first thing you would go towards is something cataclysmic. This is a neutron star that has gone supernova or collapsed into a black hole. Some powerful star-level event to create that much energy that quickly. Those types of events don't repeat. If a neutron star collapses into a black hole,
that's the garbage can falling down the stairs. Right.
Exactly. It only does it once. You can only shatter the vase once. And so when we found them repeating, and we found some that were repeating before this one, it said that there's something that's not right. There's something that's not cataclysmic here. And then when we find it as a very regular pattern, that even narrows it down more, because there are a lot of things that wouldn't be cataclysmic but wouldn't be so precise. So we know variable stars. Betelgeuse is one that we may talk about later. But it brightens and dims. But it doesn't do it like clockwork. It doesn't do it exactly every so many days. And these fast radio bursts do.
Let me read what the researchers say. They say one explanation is orbital motion. Celestial bodies are known to orbit on regular timescales, so a pair of objects, like a star and a black hole, could account for the 16-day pattern. The paper says, quote, given the source's location in the outskirts of a massive spiral galaxy, a supermassive black hole companion seems unlikely, although lower-mass black holes are viable, end quote. So celestial bodies, is that the first thing?
That's the first thing that would come to me. For that periodic, it would be something orbital.
So it's two things crossing in front of one another at various timescales.
Right. Or going close and then farther away. So you could have, say, a black hole and some type of star.
So if I was walking at the exact same speed around your house, I would pass through one window at the same time.
Right? Yes.
And this is what you'd be seeing, some kind of an object circling another object.
Yeah. You walk around my house and I see the room dim slightly every time you walk around because you block some of the sunlight.
Okay. And if you're in the Truman Show, it's happening again and again and again and again. And this is the Truman Show version of that, but that would be normal, I guess, or normal-ish in a spiral galaxy like this, because there's a lot of things that could be passing in front of one another, yes?
Right.
It's, again, a sort of a buzzkill. The black hole thing, though, I don't fully get. Not a massive black hole, but a lower-mass black hole?
Something multiple stars in mass, say 10 solar masses, something like that.
This is where the scale gets away from my brain.
Yes.
This is a big thing.
It's a small thing.
It's a small thing?
Yeah.
How small compared to in our galaxy?
Golly, I'd have to do the math off the top of my head. It would be, It would be planetary in size if it were a
small
stellar mm-hmm. mass black
hole.
So
it's not
right.
a big Twinkie.
Yeah.
So you could have a large kind of red supergiant star, for example, and this black hole is coming close to it, and it kind of scoops up some of the ionized gas from this star, and somehow, in a process we don't know, accelerates it so much and so fast that we get this massive radio burst.
Okay. Does that sound plausible mm-hmm. to you, Roger?
Totally. Dooley? Totally.
Anything else on the list? I mean, the authors say FRBs could be generated if giant radio pulses from an energetic neutron star are eclipsed by a companion object. They also note that periodicity could arise from the rotation of a star, but that's a mm-hmm. tricky hypothesis. But in short, aliens not on the list. So,
right.
Okay. So before we move on to some other subjects, because we assume it's not aliens, is this even interesting? When you get radio waves like this, is there value in this, Brian?
It's extraordinarily interesting because this is a very high energy process. We now know that it's periodic in many cases. So something is creating this massive amount of energy on a regular basis, which is a new astrophysical process that we don't understand. It's something new that's happening in the universe naturally.
Or new to us,
that is going to help us understand things like black holes or neutron stars or how binary systems interact. You know, there's a whole range of things that this could be. And by figuring out what it is, it's going to help us understand the universe a bit better.
So what do they do next with studying this? I mean, how do you gain something further from this?
So the telescope of Canada is going to be gathering dozens of these every month. Because it's such a radically different design, we've been getting, you know, handfuls of them. This thing's going to constantly catch these things. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have this wealth of data when it fully goes online. And that's where things are going to change, because now we'll have hundreds of them in a year. And we'll be able to look at some of, you know, the statistics and how they're different and how they're the same.
Roger?
In addition to that, if you have something that's regular, way out there at the edge of another galaxy, you suddenly have a beacon or a probe for anything that comes between us and them. So if you have an interstellar dust cloud that just happens to drift by, all of a sudden we're going to have a signal that's propagating through that will allow us to understand the intervening material. And if we have an array of these things that we've picked up over time from CHIME, for example, now we've got this ability to understand a whole bunch of places in the sky that we could analyze using these tools.
Apologies for the dumb incoming question here, but it wasn't that long ago when we really didn't have a good grasp that exoplanets were common, right? That every time you see a star, it's probably got some planets. That's relatively new to us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are radio waves more frequent, more common than we would have realized? Is that in that same sort of category of we didn't know as much, but they're out there? They're coming our way?
To some degree, yes. Okay. There are two things that are advancing in radio astronomy, and one is that we're getting extremely high-resolution images with modern observatories. So we can now get radio images that rival something from Hubble, which we'd never been able to do before because longer wavelengths make for blurrier images. So we can now do high-resolution images. And then you have telescopes like CHIME and other ones that are doing not just looking at a small patch of sky, but actually doing wide sky observations. So doing a radio sky survey will change the way we do things in the same way that optical sky surveys change the way we saw exoplanets and things like that.
Roger? Fair?
No, totally agree.
Isn't this so interesting? For the non-scientists, this whole thing of radio bursts was all about, it's aliens. And then it's like, it's not aliens, so we're moving on. Whereas the scientific community sees tremendous value in this.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
Even if it's not aliens. Let me get our first phone call, Tom in Rochester. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I was wondering, when you hear about the Air Force jets going out to check out the UFOs, or the airline pilots telling that they saw something, couldn't that be the radio signals?
So you're saying, Tom, when airline pilots are doing what? They're sent to look for UFOs?
When they see something, they record it.
Okay.
And when the Air Force jets go out to check out a UFO, couldn't the UFO be sending signals? They can't catch them, so who knows what they're doing.
You're talking about the UFOs that have reached our atmosphere, but we can't catch.
The U.S. just cannot catch them.
Okay. That hasn't happened that we know of, though, right?
Well, it's been reported. It's U.S. jets. It's American jets. They're going up. They're not playing. So could the UFOs that they're chasing be sending the signals?
Tom, thank you for the phone call. And I'm going to let our scientists weigh in just a moment. I will preface this by saying I think what he's saying is jets sent into the atmosphere to track down UFOs, which, again, hasn't happened that we know of.
Yeah, I believe there was something, I think it was the U.S. Navy, that released footage of objects they couldn't describe, they couldn't understand, you know, and then everybody comes on with, well, they're UFOs. Well, they could be drones. They could be other planes that are a little bit more stealthy. So even the Navy isn't saying that they're UFOs.
You know what's, like, funny about this, Roger Doobie? I'm the guy who every time you guys come in, I try to get you to say it's aliens. That's about radio waves from deep space. That's about, you know, Dyson swarms or potential Dyson swarms around stars that are seeing light signals flicker. I am the last guy on the planet who's on board that UFOs have ever been here. I'm just not. We have no evidence of it. I am not a conspiracy theorist. And I appreciate time. I mean, I appreciate the phone call. I'm not belittling. People believe things for various reasons. But that would be one of the biggest news stories we ever had. And I don't know how long people think the government could suppress that. But no, we don't. Unfortunately, we haven't been visited. I would love to think we have, but we have not.
Correct.
Though I'm going to get some emails today for this.
Oh, probably.
Probably.
That's right. Yep.
I'm sorry. We have no evidence that we have been visited.
Correct. Right.
Fair enough.
Right.
Yes. And to Brian's point, by the way, unidentified doesn't mean alien. As much as I joke, unidentified means unidentified. There's a lot of natural explanations. One of the problems we have, maybe I'm contributing to the conspiracy theory by my constantly shouting aliens, I always get talked down by these guys because I'm an evidence guy. That's why they're here. You know, they're the sober ones who are bringing me sort of back out of the clouds on this. But I do think it's important that we deal in a world of evidence. And in our second half hour, we'll talk about some other things that are on their radar. I do want to talk about some of the other comments that Loeb made about the likelihood that if we could actually get out and travel a little bit, that we'd bump into traffic. So, you know, again, that is conjecture. Is that helpful? So we'll talk about that and a lot more with our guest, Brian Koberlein, astrophysicist and science writer with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, and Roger Doobie, an experimental physicist and a professor emeritus at RIT. They're not alien. They're very smart. And we're right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, the Golisano Foundation, Special Olympics, and Best Buddies are joining together to host the first ever Festival of Inclusion on Sunday, March 1st, an opportunity to discuss ways to create a more inclusive and accessible community. Our guests will share their ideas and experiences. You know, it's a big part of the mission of conversation that we have here at WXXI. Join us Thursday on Connections. Welcome back to The X-Files. I'm Evan Dawson. There are these moments where producer Megan Mack looks at me through the glass and is like, what are you doing? Why? You're going to get emails. You're going to get phone calls. You're going to upset people. This is probably one of those, because if I talk about UFOs aren't real, it's going to happen. I'm going to get some emails. People are going to be very upset with me. I want you to know that if you email me about UFOs, I'm always open to evidence. Always open to evidence. Evidence is good. I'm a big fan. Skepticism is good. Andrew writes and says, so are they AM radio waves, 1370, FM radio waves, 88.5, and can we pick them up on our smart speakers? Those are radio waves that are coming out of our tower, yes? Those are radio waves.
Mm-hmm. Those are radio waves.
Yes.
Artificially created.
Probably not strong enough to get all the way to a spiral galaxy 500 million light years away, or no?
They'd be extraordinarily faint.
Extraordinarily faint.
Right.
So they're probably not listening to Connections on Alpha Centauri. Though they should.
They should.
Because yeah. You know.
It should be stimulating.
We're open-minded.
That's right.
So let me grab David and Canandaigua next on the phone. Go ahead, David.
Hi, Evan and the presenters. I was talking with a friend recently about the Starlink project and the satellites, and I was interested. One of your presenters is discussing the improved imaging and all the wonderful images that are coming from some of these earthbound telescopes and all that. Has there been a problem with Starlink or other recent things that have been sent into orbit? And what are the plans to reduce some of that visual and signal clutter at the moment?
So, yes, Starlink is to some degree a problem. How it might be mitigated is something that's still a very fierce debate. I would say Starlink is a different problem than ordinary satellites for two reasons. One is they're low Earth orbit, and so they will be brighter and move more quickly across the sky, and also the high number of them. So we deal with debris in space all the time already, but this is like an order of magnitude more. In fairness to Elon Musk, he's not the only guy trying to do this. So there are lots of other low Earth flotillas that are either in the planning stage or in the development stage. This is a problem we're going to have to address as a human society.
Okay. That helped there.
Right. Thank you very much. Yeah, I appreciate that.
David, thank you very much. One of our listeners on Twitter points me to Pine Bush, New York, the UFO capital of New York. Pine Bush, New York, found in northern Orange County. Orange County? I guess it's Orange County. It's far from a normal quiet suburb. It has the highest number of UFO claimed sightings in New York State. This is sent to me through weirdus.com. And I would just say when that happens, it's probably an issue of contagion, I would think. You know, your neighbors start talking about UFOs. You see a quick flash in the sky. There's probably a contagion aspect to it, you would think.
It could be. I mean, I've seen a lot of weird things in the sky that I didn't know what they were. But I haven't seen anything that was aliens.
Okay.
There are some physiological things that could confuse people also. You know, you're staring up at the sky, your eyes are fixed in a particular region, and then you move your eyes quickly to a different part, and the ghost images on the retina will follow your eye, and suddenly it appears like, wow, that thing just moved way over there very quickly, and there was and now it's gone. That's because it was a ghost image on the retina and not really something in the sky. So there are a variety of different things that can certainly contribute to the confusion that people have, and I think that's why the need for evidence is pretty high.
Sure.
We really need to have that to be able to move that forward.
Sure. So Patrick writes to us to kind of point out the difference between Avi Loeb from Harvard and someone like Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan believed in the likelihood of aliens, but also understood the extreme distances that would separate intelligent societies. And Patrick goes on to say that Sagan essentially argues against our own current experience of aliens, saying that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Well, here's Vox reporting on what Avi Loeb said out of Harvard on the broader debate over alien life. Quote, scientists disagree about how to interpret phenomena like FRBs in large part because they disagree about how plausible alien life is in the first place. In statistical terms, they have different priors, meaning that the background assumptions they are using to interpret new evidence are different. From one perspective, the universe is astonishingly large, full of habitable planets like Earth, where life could evolve as it did here. Sometimes that life would become intelligent. We'd expect such a universe to have lots of flourishing civilizations as well as lots of extinct ones. That is clearly the expectation that motivates Loeb at Harvard, who said, quote, as soon as we leave the solar system, I believe we will see a great deal of traffic out there. He said this last year. And he concluded by saying, possibly we'll get a message that says, welcome to the Interstellar Club, or we'll discover multiple dead civilizations. That is, we will find their remains, end quote. I feel like my guests in studio think that this kind of conjecture is kind of pointless. Do you, Brian?
I think he makes a point, but not in the way that he thinks he's making.
What do you mean?
I think he's right that if you assume aliens are extraordinarily common, then using aliens as an explanation for phenomena would be very likely. But that assumption is where the flaw lies, because we don't have evidence to know whether or not alien life is common or rare. We have a sample size of one, and we have a lot of interesting support that it could be common, and it certainly could be common, but we don't have any evidence to say that it is.
There's something like 10 billion trillion planets that would be similarly situated to their star as we are here.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that they are bubbling with life. That doesn't mean their surfaces are the same, their atmospheres are the same.
Exactly.
10 billion trillion is a lot of chances. And we also don't know how microbial life becomes intelligent life. So,
right.
So the bottom line is, when Loeb is saying he thinks we'd see a lot of traffic if we just get outside of our galaxy, it sounds like you don't necessarily think we would.
I don't want to stick with the assumption and then skew my conclusions.
I think that's a very wise point. Roger?
For a long time, since I was a grad student, there have always been two camps of astrophysicists on this topic. As Avi does, there's the group that says, there are so many habitable planets, surely there are aliens out there, and we're going to run into them. The other group, by the same token, said, there are so... The likelihood of life arising on a planet is so low and requires such perfect conditions that even with this large number of habitable planets, we're probably not going to find anything for a long time. And so you get these two groups and they just cannot see eye to eye.
I tend to think, listening to Brian, that we can be of two minds sort of in parallel here, which is you can think the likelihood of intelligent civilizations is pretty high given the number of Goldilocks zone planets or exoplanets out there, while also saying, I'm not going to assume that that has happened now or ever because it could color my interpretation of new data. In other words, until we experience actual civilized life, I don't factor it in at all to my thinking so as not to be biased, even though if you ask me just personally, do I think it's likely, I could say yes. Is that right?
Yeah. So here's another point. We don't have confidence that we understand all of the variables that go into the appearance of life on a planet or the evolution to civilized advanced life. For example, we have a moon. The moon causes tidal motion. This washes the ocean up onto the shore in a regular pattern. It withdraws twice a day and then comes back up. That helps the evolution of species because things that get washed up onto the shore are suddenly up there for 12 hours and they need to survive. So those that can survive are selected for. Without the moon, that process of pushing evolution at a higher speed goes away. Now all of a sudden, all you've got is wind causing the lapping of waves onto the shore, and that's it. There are no big tides pushing large quantities of protozoa up onto the shore. So, and that's just the presence or absence of a moon. Imagine all the other factors that could go into this thing. It's really complex.
No, obviously, we've got no clue how often this has or has not happened.
Mm-hmm.
But you're laying out the case of just how remarkable it is that it has happened at all.
Yes. To throw gasoline onto the fire, I will point out that there's a famous experiment by Miller and Urey where they reconstructed the conditions of early Earth, and voila, after running this for a short time, they found initially 5 amino acids. More recent analysis of their samples shows that it's actually 23 amino acids. And that's just sitting in a flask that has boiling water with the right kind of atmospheric conditions and an electrical discharge to provide some extra energy. That's all that they had going. They didn't even have all this other stuff like waves and things. And they were able to produce amino acids. So heck, if you can do that in a lab with just some chemicals off the shelf, that makes it sound easier than we might be thinking. So there are arguments on both sides.
How are we a species that can do what you just described and yet still has three-way rest stop bathrooms? I mean, like, just the one end. Mm-hmm. Just an amazing range of what humans are capable of. Roger Doobie, Brian Koberline, our guests. We're going to talk about Betelgeuse, Betelgeuse, in a second. But Andrew writes to say, hold on, let me pull it back up. Evan, Mr. Open-Minded doesn't believe in UFOs. That's telling. Andrew, I'm going to say again, I'm open to UFOs, man. I'm open to it. I don't believe that we've ever seen a civilized alien civilization send an object to our atmosphere that's either crashed, that's been stolen down into a government lab, that's been photographed. I don't. I think we would know a little bit more than we do now. I'm open to it. I'm open to evidence. I'm always open to evidence. I don't believe in ghosts. I'm open to evidence. This is another one of those things where Megan Mack's going to look at me and say, don't do this. I'm open to it. And I know a lot of people do, and I respect that. I think it would be the biggest news story in the history of the world if ghosts were proven to be true. But I also understand some people believe very strongly that that's true, and I respect their belief and their experience. It is not mine, so I'm open to evidence. That's all I'm saying, Andrew. You got evidence of UFOs? Kick it our way. But let's talk about something different. Let's talk about... you didn't say Betelgeuse earlier. What did you say?
Betelgeuse.
What do you say, Roger?
I said Betelgeuse.
So Betelgeuse.
Betelgeuse is fine.
Yeah. It's Betelgeuse. Betelgeuse. What's the story here, guys?
It's been getting extraordinarily dim.
Wait. What is Betelgeuse?
Okay, so if you look at Orion, and you look up at the sky, you see Orion.
Yeah.
The arm or hand that he has up to the left of the Orion constellation, that's Betelgeuse. It's a red giant. It's been one of the brightest stars in the sky for a very long time. And all of a sudden, within the last year, it's dropped to one-third of its brightness. One-third in the span of a year. So something's going on with that thing.
Okay, and... I think the brief reporting I've seen indicates it's on its way out until it flares up and it goes supernova?
Yes.
Okay. What is supernova?
So a supernova is when, in this case, when the star runs out of fuel, it runs out of things that it can fuse to fight against gravity. Gravity is constantly trying to crush a star, and in order to fight that, the star has to fuse elements and create enough pressure and heat to push back. So our sun does this. Every star does this. Betelgeuse has basically used up all of the hydrogen that it can fuse. So it's now fusing helium.
How do we know? Just because of the dimming?
We know it has nothing to do with the dimming. We know because it's a red supergiant. So basically, our sun mostly fuses hydrogen into helium, and it releases a little bit of energy, and that's how it creates its light and heat. Hydrogen to helium is a pretty steady fusion process. So stars maintain a nice, stable, long-lived lifetime during that. When you move up to heavier elements, they tend to react faster and more intensely. So when you start fusing helium instead of hydrogen, you're now basically turning up the temperature to try and cook more stuff. And so what's happened is that as it has done that, the outer layers of the star have expanded to become this supergiant star.
That happens to all stars eventually?
It happens to many stars. So our sun, for example, won't be a red supergiant, but it will become a red giant star in about 5 billion years.
5 billion
years. Our days are numbered.
Our days are numbered. Our days are numbered. You know, you thought you had it all going for you, and then you find this out. So why is Betelgeuse been a story then? Because if it's dimming now, Roger, what do we assume is happening?
Well, so it's not a question of assuming what's happening as much as what are the possible things that could be happening,
okay,
and how can we investigate those? So one of the first things that comes to mind is, oh, gee, maybe this is going to go supernova. And if it goes supernova, it would be spectacular. It would be as bright as the moon, and it would be like that for 3 months. And so you'd have this other object in the sky that's very bright for 3 months. It would be a very dramatic effect because the thing is only 7 light years away. It's really not that far. So that's theory number one. But usually there's a signature to some of the emissions that says, oh, yeah, there's every reason to believe this is going to go supergiant. And I believe that for this star, we don't see those signatures. So then the question is, well, what's going on? The other thing that we've noticed is that we've recently been able to image the surface of the star with some of our telescopes, because this is a big star. And we've seen that you could say its shape has changed. Or you could say something has moved into the between us and the star that's obscuring part of the surface of the star. We don't know which, but something's happening there. So it could be that the thing that looks like it's eclipsing part of the star might have caused the dimming because a big chunk of the star suddenly is obscured by this dark cloud. So that might be what caused the dimming. Or maybe that the star injected a big chunk of matter and that's actually a hole that's now been popped off. We don't know. There are several things that could be done with that.
Does this mean that Orion, for those who are, you know, sort of enjoying stargazing, it will never be the same?
Well, if it went supernova, it would be different for a period of time. Yes, that's
how long?
True. Well, again, 3 months about being 3 months. Bright as the moon, that's pretty significant.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
I'm ready for that.
Yeah.
And then it would be gone.
And then it would be
then
gone.
Then it would be gone.
Then all
you
of
just
a sudden,
have a nebula.
Yep.
But it's how much dimmer is it now?
A third of what it was last year.
So, I mean, people are noticing it now.
You can see it. If you're familiar with Betelgeuse, mm-hmm. you can see that it's dimmer than what it was.
Okay. So there you go, stargazers. Some knowledge there on Orion, one of the more popular constellations, and some news on what's happening there. Before we close the program, let's squeeze in a little more feedback. John and Henrietta, go ahead, John.
Yeah, when I was in the Air Force, mid-60s to 1970, out in California, one of my workmates there on the base came in all excited, claimed to have seen a UFO, strangest aircraft or craft he'd ever seen. It was years later we found out that was a prototype B-1 bomber.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, some of these UFO sightings, obviously they're not going to advertise when they're flying experimental aircraft. You know?
Right.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, John. I appreciate that. I mean, I'm not at all saying that there aren't extraordinary experiences that are unusual or hard to explain, but you must have extraordinary evidence. And time again, we find out that this wild set of lights or this object was very much explainable,
mm-hmm.
just was hard to explain at the moment. Nothing wrong with that.
Yep.
That's cool.
Yep.
And we could probably point out a lot. So, John, thank you for that. Drew, real quick in Rochester. Go ahead, Drew.
Yeah, this question. You guys mentioned earlier that if we were receiving a signal from another universe, that universe would be dead.
That civilization?
That's right. Well, not civilization, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
But my question is, well, what if they're receiving something from us and they assume the same thing? If that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does, Drew. Thank you. But just keep in mind that if they are receiving something from us, it's probably well into the future of what we consider time. Like right now, signals that have been sent out or even in recent years would take a long, long, long time to reach any actual alien civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
He's asking, should they assume that we're dead if they're receiving signals from us?
Not necessarily. If they were receiving signals from us, they would have to be within probably about 40 or 50 light years from Earth.
Okay.
And so they would be able to triangulate, oh, it's coming from Sol. It's coming from this specific star that's only 40 or 50 light years away.
Sure.
So that's likely to still be around.
But I'm sorry. Go ahead, Roger.
No, so I was going to say the reason he's saying 40 or 50 years is because that's when we became active in the radio spectrum. Before that, we didn't have radio, and so nothing was being transmitted.
I gotcha. Okay, but our radio waves would have to travel.
Exactly.
A long way
right. For a long time. Mm-hmm.
And I think what he's saying is by the time they get to wherever they're going, that civilization might assume we're cooked by then.
Yeah.
So if there's a civilization in the Andromeda Galaxy, which is about 2.5 million light years away,
yeah.
If they were picking up our signal, they would know that it was sent 2.5 million years ago. Will we still be around in 2.5 million years?
We're still driving Hummers, and we know climate change is happening. I'm not so sure we're going to be here in 2.5 million years.
That's the point.
Okay. Well, last minute, real quick. Speaking of not being here, we just heard a story of another near miss from an asteroid. Scientists watched a newfound asteroid zoom by Earth. I mean, it wasn't zooming by. It wasn't all that close. How concerned should we be about that as opposed to No, Roger?
Zero.
Zero.
That was not a near miss. That was 15 times the distance from here to the moon. 15 times.
How come I keep reading it was, a near miss?
I don't know. They thought it was a good way to sell papers. Yeah. I don't know. that is not a near miss for me.
But you're not worried about this.
I don't even think about it unless it at least comes between the Earth and the Moon. Now, here's some food for thought. In 2029, there is an asteroid that is about 1,000 feet in diameter and size, and it is going to come inside the GPS satellite orbit. It's going to be so close to Earth, it's going to be closer than the GPS satellites are. And we're going to be able to see it with our naked eye. That one worries me. 2029.
Should we be like setting up some guns to take that thing down? Sending Bruce Willis?
No, we know where that pass is going to be.
We're sure of that.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've got the orbit.
Is that between the moon and us?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God, yes. It's inside our GPS satellites.
It's like it's 30,000 really, kilometers.
It's really close.
2029.
Yep. 2029.
All right, once again, now you know, get it all done before 2029, everyone. Heal your relationship. Say you're sorry. You know, go visit what you want to do.
April 13th, that's the date.
That's the
date. April 13th, 2029.
But that sounds like you think it's actually going to be a cool event and not a risky one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's gonna be a near miss. That's a near miss by anyone's definition.
All right. We joke, but we are so grateful for their expertise and their explanation. Roger, Brian, always good. Thank you very much for the time this hour.
Always our pleasure.
Thank you,
Evan.
Thanks to Don volunteering, Emma Ray Stein, the intern, Megan Mack producing and engineering. I'm Evan Dawson, sending radio waves to wherever you are. Talk to you tomorrow.